Hi, my name is Sean Silverthorne. I'm the editor of HBS Working Knowledge, and welcome to another Working Knowledge podcast. On May 9th, renowned Pulitzer Prize winner and Harvard Business School historian Alfred D. Chandler, Jr. died at the age of 88. Among his many accomplishments, Professor Chandler was credited with establishing business history as an independent and important area for study. His work in books, articles, and research was extraordinarily influential in shaping how we think about the modern corporation today. But he was also an extraordinary person and deeply influenced the research and careers of many colleagues at Harvard Business School. One of those colleagues is with us today. Richard S. Tedlow is the class of 1949 Professor of Business Administration at HBS, where he is a specialist in the history of business. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Sean.
Now, you have a long history with Al Chandler. Can you tell me a little bit about when you first met him and what were some of your first impressions of him?
Well, first let me just say a word about your introduction. I would add that he not only has had a tremendous impact on all of us who do history here at the Harvard Business School, but all around the world. I mean, he's a global figure. My own first encounter with him, actually, was through a book called Strategy and Structure, which he wrote, which he published in 1962. I read in 1972. And I met him in 1973 at a seminar on the nature of business history, which he was the chair of and which I was one of the contributors to at Brandeis University. Mm-hmm. So I knew him from 1973 until his recent death.
So you knew him before you actually met him through his works.
No, I met him through his works before I knew him.
Right,
in other
exactly.
Words, I read Strategy and Structure before meeting him. I also read The Beginnings of Big Business in American Industry, which is a very famous, very widely reprinted article. Al wrote extensively in the Business History Review prior to my meeting him, and certainly in the 1950s. He published his first book, which was his doctoral dissertation, which was on his great-grandfather, Henry Varnum Poor, who was one of the founders of Standard & Poor's. And so I was familiar with his work. The article, Coming of Big Business to American Industry, had been widely reprinted. So whenever you would buy, as a young history graduate student or what have you, a collection of articles, that one would invariably be there. So I met him first that way and then in person in 73.
Well, we often form opinions of authors through their writing, and I wonder, once you met the man and talked to him, what were your impressions of him as a person, seeing him?
Well, it's an appealing question to me, because I remember it very vividly. I mean, it might as well have been yesterday, as they say. And we met with a doctoral student of his in Cambridge. We had dinner there. He picked up the check, actually, and then we drove out to Waltham and went to Brandeis. And what the graduate students at Brandeis who had organized this get together wanted to know was, what is business history? And both I and his doctoral student Chuck Cheap did was, we presented the work that we were doing, and then Al, who was already world famous in 1973, was asked directly by a fellow named Ray Arsenault, who was running the seminar, you know, what is business history, and gave a very good answer. He struck me as being very appropriate, friendly. I wouldn't call him effusive on first meeting, but you know, every inch the professional. I mean, a complete master of the subject matter he was discussing.
And he was a master of many subjects, it seems, as if. And I know a lot of the faculty that I've talked to are struck by the fact that Al would come up to him and say, "What are you working on now?" And he was always judging you by what you were working on, the problem or what you were trying to... Did you experience that with him?
Well, I actually don't think he ever asked me that question directly, because I knew him so well once I got here that I got here to the school in 1978. He was one of the people who selected me for a fellowship to come here, and then I've been here ever since. And so we saw each other quite regularly. And so he always knew what I was working on. And, and there was a business history seminar, which was inaugurated by Tom McCraw, another Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who Al was pivotal in getting to come to the school. The business history seminar began in 1984. It's still running today. And we would all present papers every year on what it was we were working on. So we always knew. What his own work, it was utterly fascinating to watch it evolve. He focused on area in, if you look at the history profession, if you go to the American Historical Association or the Organization of American Historians, what have you, those are two different organizations. The AHA, the American Historical Association, is for anybody doing history. The Organization of American Historians is for people doing specifically American history. Business history is not a major focus of either of those organizations. So Al, by choosing to become an historian of business enterprise, and was in a sense choosing a road pretty much, you know, less taken, less traveled. Moreover, he was not what one would call an economic historian. Today, most economic historians are basically historical economists. They take the tools of economics and they apply it to historical events. Al was an institutional historian. Al was interested in the strategy and the structure of the business corporation. He was interested in how things worked in companies. His single most important contribution was changing the nature of the debate. Prior to Al, business history had either been basically antiquarian. In other words, you'd have company histories. They would be very, very long. Nobody would read them cover to cover. CEOs would give them to people who came to their offices, you know, gifts or whatever. They were virtual coffee table books if they weren't actual coffee table books. So there was that set, which had very little audience. And the other set of people who did business history were the people who were quite concerned about, as Al would put it, whether business executives were good fellows or bad fellows. There was a famous exchange between Al and Nevins, who was sort of on the right of the political spectrum, and Matthew Josephson, who was on the left of the political spectrum and wrote a famous book on the 1930s called The Robber Barons. There was an exchange between these people, I think it was in 1952, it was in the early 1950s in any event, in a Saturday Review of Literature called Should American History Be Rewritten? And there was this long-running debate between how do you look at American business tycoons, do you look at them as robber barons or as industrial statesmen? And what Al did was he said, you know, historians are not particularly well-positioned to answer that question. That's more a question for philosophers or, you know, it's not that it's not an important question, but it's not necessarily an historical question. It's up to the historians to find out what exactly business people did in businesses. And what was discovered when Al went to work on this question was that nobody knew very much about it. Nobody really knew what it meant to establish strategy in a company. Nobody knew what the relationship between how a company was organized and what strategy it was able to pursue, how that relationship worked. So once he opened that door, you could go deeper and deeper and deeper and further in that direction, whereas for historians, anyway, who are not moral philosophers, arguing about whether people about whom you don't really know that much are either good or bad, you can't push that very far. Al, by changing the nature of the debate almost single-handedly, one reviewer of one of his books once said he's the only historian whom economists have to take seriously by saying, you know, what really does a business do? What do corporations do and how do they do it? That made the kind of history that he wrote relevant to the business world, because that's a question that executives ask themselves all the time. It made the kind of history that he wrote relevant to business school students, and it made possible the flowering of business history at the Harvard Business School because you could teach courses that students would want to know. I mean, if you taught, as I do, I mean, his cases on John D. Rockefeller, you can get 2 days, and believe me, the students here at this institution will be extremely interested in finding out who Rockefeller was, how he built a startup company in the oil industry, which was how he organized his company, how he made it as effective and successful as it was. So Al opened up ways of looking at Standard Oil, ways of looking at the railroads, ways of looking at the DuPont Corporation, for example. The second chapter of Strategy and Structure is a brilliant description of why DuPont was unable to change its strategy without changing its structure, how its structure was actually preventing it from moving forward strategically. And nobody knew that at the time. They found that out in real time, and he brings you back to memo by memo by memo. This is what the arguments were. And so it's a completely different kind of a debate from whether Irenae DuPont was a good person or a bad person, or whether Pierre DuPont was a good person or a bad person. Not that those are irrelevant questions in life, but they weren't relevant to Al and his work. And because of his focus on the questions of what did these people really do? How did these businesses actually work? How do you know that a diversification that you are planning is related or unrelated? If it's related, how do you organize the company to make it go? He opened up that whole constellation of questions and therefore defined the field.
And I'm wondering how he did that. I mean, just that process where no one had gone before in terms of trying to go into companies, understand the people running them. Today, when you go into a company, they kind of know what to expect. You're going to be there. You're going to look at the books. You're going to talk to executives. But then here comes this fellow named Alfred Chandler wanting to look at a company. How did that process evolve?
Well, Al, I think from childhood, was always interested in how things worked. He was brought up in many ways close to nature. He sailed through the Panama Canal to the Galapagos Islands with his father in the 1930s. I remember his showing me a trophy he won in a yachting race in Nantucket in a country club there once in the 1980s. He won it in the 1930s. I saw it in the 1980s. He bought land, I believe, in the 1940s in Nantucket, and used to love to duck hunt, and was in the Navy. He was in naval intelligence, and was fascinated by the fact that you could take pictures of plants before they were bombed and then after they were bombed, and that sometimes a plant would look like it was completely obliterated, but it would still be putting out product. And sometimes you just somehow there'd be one little corner of a plant that would be destroyed and the place would be completely disabled. So finding out how things worked, why that happened, became something that just fascinated him his whole life.
You can't talk to too many faculty members at Harvard Business School without a duck story, a duck hunting story coming up. He's also an avid fisherman. What do you think his love of the outdoors and of the sporting life, did that influence his work at all?
I think he was broadly informed in a way that historians of my generation, who, in other words, went to the graduate school in the 1970s, are relatively less so. He was broadly informed about natural phenomena, about this is going to sound trivial, but believe me, it isn't, about tides, currents, where it was likely to be windy, at what times of the year. If you're studying, if you're beginning your work in the early 19th century, where commerce was by sail, that's actually a pretty important thing to know. His own appreciation of the rise of New York Port was clearly informed by his own interest in sailing, and his appreciation of the difficulties that railroads had to overcome in order to become what they were in this country, which knit, they created a national market. They knit the country. They knit the country together. Was broadly informed by the fact that he'd been around and he saw that, you know, for example, there was wood in some places and not in others. You could have fuel for roads in some places you couldn't have in others. You could build ties in some places you couldn't in others. So his understanding of the canal network was greatly informed by the fact that, you know, there was water in certain places and not in others. So he wasn't just the kind of historian who spent his whole life in a library and never went outside. And therefore was, you know, he was able to avoid, you know, errors that you know, can easily be made if you don't understand that, you know, you cannot build a railroad in certain circumstances because of the terrain or what have you. He was aware of those things. And his awareness of the world around him in a natural way, his closeness to nature, I think did affect his writing, actually.
Richard, we were talking a little bit about the legacies that Al Chandler left behind, and you mentioned the understanding of the modern corporation and the modern business leader, understanding the motivations there. Can you touch on some other areas where Al has left his mark?
Well, one is and this is relatively unacknowledged, but it's really quite important. At the Harvard Business School, developing a course is very difficult. And Al was a great course developer. I mean, he changed the name of the business history course at the Harvard Business School. When he came here, it was called Business History. He changed it to The Coming of Managerial Capitalism. So, in other words, immediately the course has a thesis. It's about something. It's not just about business history. It's about once there were no such things as managers. I mean, if you look at John Jacob Astor, who died in 1848, the richest man in the United States, he ran his company from a tiny little room. There were just a couple of clerks. There was no managerial hierarchy. By the late 19th century, there were managerial hierarchies. Where did they come from? Who was the manager? It's a new Homo economicus. Who was this person? Why did managerial capitalism appear in some industries but not in others? And what Al was able to do in asking this question was to see through theory. In other words, put theory aside and let's try to actually find out what actually happened. There's a famous phrase in German, history, wie es eigentlich gewesen, as it actually was. And theory, you know, it's been said there's nothing as useful or nothing as practical as a good theory. Al put theory aside and tried to find out what, you know, how companies actually worked. And it was this tremendous desire to get to reality that was a major motivating force. In the process of that, he built a theory of his own about, you know, the coming of management, you know, why managers came when they did and what they did when they ran businesses. And in so doing, he shed a whole new light on the agency problem, which is a major problem in the business academy today, and made all this teachable in a course which you know, has turned out to be quite a successful course over the passages of the last quarter of a century.
One of the amazing things about Professor Chandler was he worked almost up to his dying day, I would assume. What was the source of the wellspring of that energy and that drive to keep working?
There was an insatiable curiosity. I mean, he worked because he wanted to find out the answers to questions which fascinated him. And he worked, he seemed never to tire. He was so committed to finding out these answers. You know, once there was no such thing as management, now there is. Why did that happen? Why did it happen in some industries and not in others? Why is that some industries rise and some fall at other times? He kept working, he moved on. He didn't keep, you know, working in the same mine. He'd go to another mine and maybe, you know, look for another metal. He started working on the computer industry later in his life and what have you. So it wasn't just the America of the Detroit-Pittsburgh economy, although his most well-known book is The Visible Hand. That's and that that is a book that goes basically from 1840 to 1920. But Scale and Scope, which was published in 1990, this is a comparative history. This is something the historical profession's been calling for forever. And he went outside the borders of the United States, well, you know, to examine British enterprise, to examine German enterprise, done a great deal of work on Japanese enterprise, all of which is extremely difficult. And the reason that he kept working was that he kept growing. His work was a living, breathing thing for him. It wasn't something that was cast in concrete and then you could forget about it.
Do you have any personal stories or memories of dealing with him?
Well, I have a million. you know, we were, we became friends as well as colleagues, and my late beloved wife was a psychiatrist, and she got a huge kick out of Al, and Al and his wife Faye and I and my late wife Joyce, we went out a lot. He would often take us to a club down in the Back Bay, and then we'd go to the Handel and Haydn Society. And one, I'll never forget, once I suggested to Al and Faye that I take them to the opera in New York. They had taken me out so often here, and I wanted to reciprocate. And Faye was very, Faye Chandler is an artist, and she was very enthusiastic about the opportunity to go to the opera. She had never been to the Metropolitan Opera. And Al's face absolutely sunk. I mean, it dropped to the floor. I mean, you could see that the thought, and you also, you know, as just an individual human being, I realized that I should have asked these people separately. I shouldn't have asked them together because he was stuck. And so anyway, I wanted this to be a good experience for him, so I chose basically a bulletproof opera, which is called Carmen by Georges Bizet, and it's in most surveys of popular operas, it's number one or number two. It's either Carmen or La Bohème. And the first act of Carmen especially is, it's full of dancing and light and very famous tunes that are actually, I mean, if you heard them, you'd recognize them, even though if you might not know they came from that a particular opera. So anyway, I managed to get the general manager's box at the Metropolitan Opera and put him in the front row, which, in other words, in an opera house that holds 3,800 people, he had the best seat in the house, and it was pretty grim. You know, he was certainly always a gentleman, but clearly not really thrilled about this. We went out to dinner, and eight of us from the school, Tom McCraw, others, and there's Al sitting in the front seat, and there's unobstructed view. And the Metropolitan puts on a tremendous. I remember Maria Ewing was the Carmen. Puts on a tremendous performance of this particular opera. And at the end of the first act, he turned around and looked at me and he said, you know, this isn't bad. And I just got such a huge kick out of this, you know, this immortal work of music, which Al had pronounced. You know, and it was really nice that he and Faye had a happy experience at this opera. He always would sit next to my wife when we went out because he always talked about his work and she would always listen to him. And I used to joke with her that she knew more about the German machine tool industry in the 1920s than any other psychiatrist in Boston. It was fun to visit him in Rowley where he had, that's where he shot ducks. It was fun to visit him in Nantucket where he owns a lot of land. It was extraordinarily interesting to be with him after hours, after he stopped working, to hear him talk about historical developments that he would never publish on because he wasn't that interested and they weren't right down the center of the plate. He was a very focused man. But he actually knew a great deal of history that was they never wrote.
Richard, what about other personal memories you may have had with him?
Well, certainly you could not have asked for a better mentor. He was extremely generous with his knowledge. He rejoiced in your success. I remember when Tom McCraw won the Pulitzer Prize, there was nobody in that room more excited than Al Chandler. And that's not to be taken for granted. Until Tom won the Pulitzer Prize, Al was the only Pulitzer Prize-winning right. historian on this campus. And you just looked at his face and you knew that not for a moment, you know, was there any... He felt it was good for the field and it was good for Tom and that Tom deserved it. And he was a man of... integrity doesn't begin to describe both how he handled his professional and life and personal life and administrative life. In other words, his life as an historian outside the school. The fact is that Al wanted to get to first principles. He believed in the he believed intensely in the importance of your research, even more than your interpretation. He once told me that whatever interpretation you put on your research is going to be someday revised. But if the research is really high quality, it's going to last forever. And he once told me that, in his view, the purest thing that a historian can do is edit somebody else's papers, because in that way, if you've got someone who's important, whose papers you're editing, you're not mediating your own interpretation between the reader and the facts. And Al, in fact, was the senior editor of Dwight D. Eisenhower's papers and was also an editor of Theodore Roosevelt's papers. So that's just part of the huge volume of work that he dispatched during the course of his lifetime.
Richard, obviously, 88 years of a great life is tough to encapsulate in a few minutes. But any other issues or areas about Al Chandler that we should discuss before we leave today?
I think that it's worth, I guess, mentioning a couple of things. First of all, there's never going to be another one. We're all unique, but Al was uniquer than most. He was a man who refused to rush his work. He worked every day. He was willing to wait until he got it right. That also deals with this issue of integrity. When you looked at his resume, which I did once when I co-authored a casebook with him, I realized that this was a true senior scholar at Harvard. It's not just that if you look at his total oeuvre, he's actually published a great deal. It's that he's never published anything that wasn't first class. He never just, you know, got rid of something in a hurry. He was always very acknowledging of people and of institutions. I mean, he was a great advocate for history in professional schools. He didn't quite say that The Visible Hand could have only been written at the Harvard Business School, but he came pretty close to saying that. And there may be some truth to that. I mean, he learned a lot about accounting here that he wouldn't have learned. You, speaking as someone who's got a PhD in history, you'd never learn in a history department. He had a wide circle of acquaintances and of friends, of devotees, of admirers, and you'd never know it. I mean, he was an extraordinarily modest man.
Richard, do you have any other recollections of him?
Al was dyslexic. And his dyslexia was, not so acute that he couldn't read, but it was pretty severe. And my wife, whom I mentioned was a psychiatrist, was astonished that he was able to make it from Exeter to Harvard to graduate school, despite the fact that he really, I mean, this was a man with a notable learning disability. He never talked about it. And Joyce, my wife, asked him point blank, you know, how did you do this? And he said, you know, I just did it. There was one point when we were doing some work on Standard Oil, without going into details, the cost of something moved from 0.54 cents a barrel to 0.45 cents a barrel during some period of time. And he looked at those numbers, 0.54 and 0.45, and he basically mumbled under his breath. He said, you have no idea how long it took me to get those numbers in the right order. And this is a man whom I knew from 1973 until his death. That was the only time during that whole period that he mentioned the result of the fact that he was dyslexic.
Wow.
So, you know, if life is, as I believe it to be, to some extent, the story of the overcoming of adversity, you know, this is a learning disability that he overcame, and to become one of the great historians of our time, one of the great scholars in the history of the Harvard Business School, a model senior scholar at Harvard University, and a beacon to all of us who want to make a difference in the work that we do.
Richard, great memories on a great life. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.